Hello and welcome to Been There, Done That, a podcast series for independent coffee shop owners brought to you by iZettle. I'm your host, Nassos Papadopoulos, a podcaster and coffee lover, and on the show I'll be picking the brains of some of the coffee industry's most influential thinkers to give you the insights you need to thrive as an independent coffee shop owner. Now, if you're in the coffee business, you've probably got a lot on your plate. But to succeed in this industry, like any other, you need to be a continuous student, staying up to date with trends and learning from the best practices of the people who've achieved what you want, who've been there and done that. And as you can probably tell from the name, that's why we made this podcast. We want to give you access to the advice you need to grow and scale your business in an easily digestible format. No fluffy content or sweeping statements, just clear, practical advice. Over the course of the series, we'll cover everything from understanding your customers to recruiting and training staff, and from making your business profitable to building relationships with suppliers. A one-stop shop for taking you to the next level with the industry's top experts. In this first episode, I speak to Maxwell Kolona-Dashwood, an independent coffee entrepreneur who runs the award-winning shop Kolona & Smalls in Bath and his own roastery, Kolona Coffee, as well as being a three-time UK barista champion. The theme of today's episode is understanding your customers. Why is understanding your customers so important? Well, your customers are the key to the success of your business. They're the ones ordering espressos and flat whites so you can cover your rent, pay your staff, and hopefully have some profit left over at the end. But how well do you actually know them? Do you know why they walk through the door in the first place? And do you know how to give them what they want so they keep coming back for more? Maxwell has spent a lot of time thinking about this, so he's the perfect person to help you get inside your customer's head to answer these questions and many others. More on that in a minute. But first, for every podcast episode in the series, we've created special bonus content, which you can access by going to the podcast section of the iZettle blog at iZettle.com or direct from the link bit.ly/iZettlePodcast. That's bit.ly/iZettlePodcast. Just choose the episode you want, go to the page, and sign up on the form to access your bonus content. Today's bonus is a cheat sheet that distills some of Maxwell's key insights and gives you some top tips on everything from talking to customers in store to engaging with them online. If you sign up as part of the bonus, you can also access the episode transcript if you'd like to get hold of the conversation in written form. Now, back to business. Maxwell and his wife Leslie own the legendary Kolona & Smalls in Bath, as I mentioned, which has become a must-visit destination for coffee lovers and now draws people from all over the UK. Maxwell's roastery, Kolona Coffee, curates some of the most incredible coffees from all over the world, and he recently launched the retail arm of the business, including a range of Nespresso-compatible pods. In this episode, we discuss a whole range of topics, including practical strategies for turning your visitors into regulars, the classic mistakes that most independent coffee shop owners make when serving customers, and how to stay on top of consumer trends, learn from the big brands, and separate fads from real insight. So whether you're looking for the micro behavioral insights to understand your customers better or the big macro lessons from the biggest players in the business, this episode will give you everything you need and much, much more. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Maxwell Kolona-Dashwood. Maxwell, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Pleasure to have you on. I'm looking forward to diving into a whole bunch of topics, mainly focused on understanding the consumer in the coffee industry. But before we get into the micro on the ground conversations with people to the big macro trends, tell me a little bit about how you got into coffee in the first place.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a convoluted story, but I think it crosses over more than maybe it seems so at first. Specialty coffee in particular seems to attract people from all walks of life. My sort of entry point is through, it's not through art, but I come from an arty family. My father's a sculptor, and I kind of assumed I'd do something to do with art when I was growing up, and I had a little bit of interest in some of the sort of technical sciences, and I was looking at doing architecture. I couldn't commit to 7 years of study, so and I just wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and so I went travelling. I got a job in a petrol station. I saved up money to go travelling instead of going to university. So I went and did this travelling around the world, and then I met my wife, Leslie. Actually, the artwork came in handy because, you know, it's real cheesy, but I sort of, the meeting point was me suggesting that I draw her, yeah. So
very nice.
Anyway, and then we saved up, and she wanted to do some travelling, and I still hadn't got the travelling bug out of the system. So I was like, sure. So we did 6 months in India, which was really full on, traveling all over the country. And we ended up in Melbourne with a working visa. And so we got a job straight away in the middle of the CBD in Melbourne. It was a conference centre. Basically, it's called Morgan's Polling, which is if you buy Time magazine and they've done a public poll about opinion, they probably ran the poll. And so I helped run their cafe at the front of the building. So I got really into the process of being a barista. And in Melbourne, you could earn pretty good money for it.
Hmm.
I changed jobs and to busier shops, but I still wasn't really interested in coffee. The bars I was working in, the coffee shops, they were using like Italian Supremo blends and stuff. But it wasn't hard to dig under the surface and see that there was more. And one of my regulars, I remember him, he always used to have poached eggs every morning. He said, look, you really should go up to this shop two blocks up in Melbourne. It's called Brother Baba Boudin. And he said, the coffee there is amazing. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go see what this is about. So my lunch break, I walked up there. And I walked into this place and it was, you know, a very cool coffee shop, if you want to use the word hipster. There was chairs upside down on the ceiling. The service from most of the staff was kind of, I wouldn't say off standoffish, but it was kind of laid back and cool. But there was one person working there, a woman who had a coffee tattoo up her leg, who was super engaged and was like, hey, you know, what would you like? And I was like, oh, I'd like to try espresso. And she said, would you like to try the single origin? It's from Kenya and it tastes like strawberries. And I stood outside on the pavement. I had this cup of coffee. And for me, that was the turning point where I went from being intrigued by coffee to like really obsessed with it.
Sure.
And then I began to research and I spent my whole year there. Me and my wife, Leslie, we both became sort of fascinated by it. And we were studying it, basically. We'd visit all the roasteries on the weekend, all the cafes. We'd read everything we could. We'd go on blogs. And I started going on training courses. And we had to go back to the UK because Leslie's mum wasn't very well. And then the UK was a really interesting point. People were saying, oh, you know, it's cool you're going back to the UK. There's this world barista champion called James Hoffman. And there's this roastery called Square Mile. And there's all these things happening in the UK. This would have been around 2008. And we came back to the UK and it was very different to Australia. The difference was that people didn't care. But generally, I think like a British thing is, on the one hand, we're quite open-minded and we want to take things from around the world. On the other hand, we're pretty anti-pretension. So
very cynical about that sort of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. Emperor's New Clothes and all that kind of stuff. So when we came back to the UK, we basically, the challenge was that people thought coffee was just coffee and it was uninteresting and they didn't care. The challenge in Australia was different. People knew coffee was interesting, but they knew the way they liked it.
What are your conversations with customers at the shop look like then in the early days and now? What types of questions are you asking to get a sense of what they want, what they know, and to what extent is that transferable for someone who's just opening their first coffee shop?
Oh, well, I really think it's changed in the UK. So that bit I said before about how hard it was, I think there's been a complete reversal. I think specialty coffee is now part of UK pop culture. I think it's gone mainstream. I don't think the quality's gone mainstream. I just think the idea, right? So I really think it's got easier. I think that big barrier at the beginning of trying to show the world that coffee could be, you know, we were kind of like shouting to everyone, going, coffee can be really special. I think there's a lot of that still in specialty coffee, but I actually don't think we need to do it anymore. I'm like, we got what we wanted. People have gone, oh, yeah, okay, cool, interesting. And now I think it's more opt-in. So actually, a customer makes a choice now about whether to come to our style of coffee shop or not, right? Whereas in the early days, it was like a coffee shop has to be... I had one guy visit once who felt that a coffee shop was a public service and our coffee shop had to do things that had been decided by everyone that coffee shops should do. So in the early days, it was really, really tough. Some of the things that I was uncomfortable about from a hospitality point of view, because ultimately I want all the customers to be happy, right? So one of the key ones was sugar. We would want to buy the most exciting coffees to us, and we want to show them to people. And then people are going, oh, this is really sour. And I'm tasting it, and I'm like, oh, have you put sugar in it? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, ah, interesting. It just hadn't occurred to me. It wasn't that I thought, oh, you're an idiot for putting sugar in it. I just hadn't realized that a huge amount of our customers were drinking the coffee in a way that was not how we were presenting it, basically. So then I was like, okay, I think if we're going to tell people that we're a specialty coffee shop where you come and taste all these amazing coffees, we're going to have to start recommending the coffee without sugar. A lot of people would say to me at the time, but it's up to the customer. I'm like, well, sure, but they didn't think it was going to go sour, right? I became really interested in psychology because I had to be, because I had to be interested in how customers interact. And the more we were creating a challenging model, the more we were challenging our customers, and the more the psychology and the sort of words you use and the way you presented things were really important.
Just cycling back quickly, in the instance of the sugar,
yeah,
how did you end up communicating that? Is that when the customer orders, the barista says, by the way, we tend not to serve this with sugar, this is how it should be? Is it something labelled on sort of the boards behind the bar? Like, how do you go about doing that?
The reason I didn't want to do it at the till is it's a bit presumptuous, which is if somebody's not going to put sugar in, then you're patronising them. Yeah. And you'll get somebody going, no, I know, I wouldn't. Right. But also, for me, you have to, if you're going to have a conversation with a customer, you start with positives, finish with negatives, and then cycle back to some more positives.
Yeah.
So what we did was, first of all, the conversations at the till can't be long. The Starbucks model has created short conversations. This is a challenge specialty coffee has. So, you know, at the price point, you need to also, on several levels, you can't have too much time at that till point. So it's going to happen at the table. Most of the time, people put the sugar themselves in at the table. Now, a little label on the sugar or in the menu, people don't read. People just don't read. So it has to be behavioural. So we pulled all the sugar off the tables. So it only arose at the point where the person would want sugar, at which point, and I struggled with, you know, making sure staff would do the right procedure here. Just something really simple like this. So somebody will say, can I have some sugar? Right. And our rationale is, you know, the coffees we buy, they're quite unusual and quite different. So we're setting off by saying to the customer, it's not you, it's us. And rather than saying what we found is, I said the truth, which is customers often find that our coffee goes really sour with sugar. So it's straight away the customer has a different, they're like, oh, your customers think this, not you, not the sort of pretentious specialist owner. And that changes the whole dynamic, right? Anyway, and then you say, but by all means, that's completely up to you. See how you get on. Now, staff, whether they knew they were doing this or not, would often do this with the sugar in their hand. Do you know what I mean? Like, and what you're saying subconsciously is, I might give this to you. I might not. And the person's like, you can see the conversation. They're not listening to what you're saying. They're just thinking, who are you? Right. So the first thing I encourage them to do is put the hand the sugar over or put it on the table. Go, look, let's get that out of the way. You can fill that full of sugar all you want. You paid for that cup of coffee. It is your cup of coffee. But you've also found, bear in mind, the way we designed our shop just quickly was we purposely chose an off the high street location because we knew that in Bath, especially where we decided to set up the shop, it's loads of tourists. And, you know, if you just wander in somewhere off the high street, it doesn't matter how you design your space. If you're a coffee shop, the assumption will be that you do X, Y, Z and you're a typical coffee shop, right?
Sure.
So by being off the beaten track, you had to find us.
So, and by wanting to find you, it's going to be a certain type of customer.
Exactly. And it's going to be lots of word of mouth. And already we're in a better position to have a conversation. And actually, we've found this opposite problem over the years is that we've put ourselves on a pedestal and said, hey, we've won these awards. We do this with coffee. And actually, if you came into that shop and just someone went flat white and they went, yep, yeah, and you sat down, you'd be disappointed, just like the specialist restaurant, right? So we don't have any part-time staff. It's all full-time staff, and they all need to be very knowledgeable, right? Which is why we don't have the individual roles like head barista. Basically, everyone cycles everything, effectively. Anyway, so with the sugar thing, even with all of that careful psychology, at the end of the day, if someone wants to take offence to that, they're going to take offence to it, right?
Sure.
They're going to say, why don't you just have it on the table? And so you get a few TripAdvisor reviews and you get people coming in and going, ooh, this is the place you're not allowed sugar. At which point, of course, we go, no, no. Of course you're allowed sugar, but we recommend against it for X, Y, Z. And it's actually ended up being good for the business. It was a talking point. People would come in and see. And ultimately, they think they're going, I don't know if you've ever seen the Seinfeld episode with the soup Nazi, right? They think they're going to that kind of place.
Yeah.
And actually, they're really surprised in a nice way. They're like, everyone was really lovely, and what they do is really great.
So how do you model that for sort of different types of consumers? Because before you were talking about, you know, the classic mistake of people making of thinking about the consumer. So mm-hmm. How granular does somebody who is a coffee professional, mm-hmm. how granular do they have to get in terms of understanding the different types of consumers? And how do you guys think about that at Kolonna and all your other projects as well? Do you have a portfolio of prototypes? Tell me how you think about it and how should people think about it?
You know, no, it's interesting. I don't know if people listening or yourself have done the UX guides where you sort of take a picture of someone who represents a customer type and group. And there's a lot more, you know, coffee is becoming more business. And there's some, I find some of that stuff useful, some of it not so useful. So I'm fascinated by branding and marketing. And we did not plan to open in Bath because of the university, but I'm so glad we did. With not just the water research and stuff, but the School of Management at Bath is really, really good. And so there's a guy called Professor Michael Beverland. He's a bit of a character. He's written a few books in branding. He's now, I think he's now in Brighton. He was professor at Bath, went back to Melbourne. He's gone back to Brighton. Anyway, he loved our business. And I got started to get invited up to his MBA class. At the beginning of his MBA class every year, he does an activity, I guess. And he gets everyone in the class and he says, I all want you to think of a brand that's shit. And everyone's like, oh, okay. And they go around the room and they're like, what's your answer? And maybe it's Costa, maybe it's Ugg Boots, maybe it's Evian, whatever. And he goes, okay, so lesson number one is all of those brands are exceptional. Otherwise, they wouldn't have popped into your head. Now, your job as a marketer isn't to just be involved in marketing products you love. You should walk out of here and never come back. You're thinking like a consumer. When I asked you the question, you're thinking, which brand resonates with me? You don't even know you're doing it, right? That's thinking like a consumer, not like the owner of a brand, right? You clearly don't understand those customers' motivations. You may even think to yourself, why would I ever buy that? Right? So the lesson is you need to go away and figure out why people buy it. You need to put yourself in the shoes of that customer. And so that sort of putting yourselves in the shoes of like basically dress rehearsing who your customers are, that's how I approach it. For me, it's all behavioral. I don't approach it as like, here's a UX document, here's a spreadsheet. That's not how my brain works at all. I hate spreadsheets. some people I work with will laugh listening. So, you know, you have to do a mixture of, from a marketing point of view and a business point of view, you're doing a mixture of guessing where your customers are going, but you'd also be stupid to not try and understand where your customers are. So I can see both sides. If I'm the big company, I'm like, okay, we need to produce a product that appeals to the mass market because we need to sell X number of units because we need to fulfill our growth and our shareholders and whatever, right? So there's this fascinating like thing that happens between these big companies operating like that and these small, innovative startups kind of. Specialty coffee was kind of like a legion of independent startups, right? And then that takes off and then the big company has to catch up.
For sure. Cycling to the macro again.
Yep.
You mentioned the big chains and how they affect the ecosystem.
Yep.
How do you try and learn from them and kind of keep your finger on the pulse of what people are doing and how that's affecting you? How do you think about that? And what can people who are independent coffee shop owners as well do to kind of keep their finger on the pulse of what's going on in the industry?
I think there's lots of things to learn from them. I think they're often much more confident at making changes to customer experience. Sometimes it backfires on them, like the names on the Starbucks cups. but a lot of these companies are built on sort of making like a bold difference. And that's often quite impressive. They, you know, I speak to people who worked at Costa who would like do menu design. And like where you place things on a menu dictate how a customer chooses. So we, after looking at that study, we moved our filter coffees to the left-hand side of the menu. So people go from left to right, and our percentage of filter sales go up, because that's people's starting point. So I think big companies have often invested a lot of time and energy in understanding customers. Sometimes they don't want to share that with you, which is fine, because it's their secret sauce that they've invested in. But there's lots there we can learn from about the way they operate. We don't have to do the same thing, but they often have like strong reasoning, which I think as an independent business, you should try and develop. You should try and think, you know, be like, okay, have we thought heavily about every aspect of our business? So that's the interesting thing that you said before about trying to understand the user and stuff. You're trying to do a mixture of understand where people are, but ultimately you need insight. And insight is not necessarily always science, right? It's complex. There's a friend of mine that I go to the gym with who wrote a book on how most businesses do product development, and they do it on asking people questions. So I think you said to me at the beginning of this podcast, you were like, oh, or at some point you said, oh, what do I ask my customers? I am very cynical and skeptical about asking customers questions.
Okay.
Really, really cynical about it. Basically, all questionnaires are massively flawed by the fact that the person doesn't tell you what they really think. And I'm not saying people are liars.
This is the mum test. type idea, right?
Go on, tell me.
So the idea that basically, you know, if you were to ask your mom a question about this business idea that you have, of course she's going to tell you that, you know, what a wonderful idea. You're not actually identifying the customer problem, because in order to identify the customer problem, they have to volunteer that information to you without you trying to get a, some sort of structured answer, i.e. if they know that you're trying to get information out of them,
they answered,
the information you'll get is not going to be the thing that you actually want to know. It's not going to be insight.
Well, the problem is as well is that generally when someone asks another human being a question, there's a complex subconscious process that goes on of A, maybe what do they want to hear? But more importantly, what should I say? The answer represents me as a person.
Yes.
So very quickly through their head is, how should I answer this? How would I want to answer this? What kind of person answers it that way, right? And it's a bit like you say to my wife, oh, you know, what do you think of smoking? She's going to be like, oh, it's dreadful. It's really, really bad. And then she's going to go outside and light up a fag, right? And a lot of those questionnaires, like what you're saying, like who you ask the question, how you ask it, like the exact wording, like they're a really flimsy dialogue. So that's why I said before, you'd have to be interested in actual behavior.
Yeah, because that's the truth as opposed to the kind of doctored, fabricated story of what the other person thinks that you want to hear.
Yes.
Or how they want to present themselves in the moment.
100%. But I think if you can understand like basic human motivation, you know, I mean, they've got the famous Steve Jobs one, right? Like, people don't know they want it yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's easy to fall back on that. And I guess I'm interested in, it's not always about innovating new. It's about, but it is about understanding people's behavior, basically. Yeah. So that's really, really interesting. And the big companies tend to be better at that.
Because they have the data, they have the statistics, they have the people to go and look at, you know, and analyze those mm-hmm. big stocks of data.
Yeah.
Whereas a small company with few resources, they're not going to be able to get that kind of deep insight in the same way. At least from the statistics perspective. Right?
Precisely. And then, like I said before, like whether you like it or not, a lot of people coming into your shop have been behaviorized, if that's the word, by those companies. So you have to be aware of how people are interacting in those companies, because you're all part of the same ecosystem. But basically, you don't want to copy anyone. Copying anyone is bad business. If you are not trying to create your own identity as a business and your own decision-making, you're going to be in trouble. If you're going, oh, that company did it, so we'll do it. Like, that's bad. That really is not good. To me, if you're really interested in understanding a product, it would be very weird to not go, okay, well, I want to listen to all the experts.
Yeah.
And I want to listen to what everyone has to say.
And then make up my own mind.
Make up my own mind and find the best possible way. And I think that's a really, if you're going to have an independent business, that needs to be your mindset. And I think running a business is difficult and you have to be up for the challenge. And part of the thing about specialty coffee is, you know, obviously a lot of us find our way into it because we're really passionate about the product. And, you know, this is age old, right? This is not new. It's sort of advice you've heard a lot. But it's that, you know, making your hobby your job or your business. And if you can do both, amazing. But ultimately, you need to be interested in turning your hobby into a business. And you have to be excited by the business side of it.
Yeah. Just like you were saying with art, like it can be a challenge at first to kind of make that transition. You struggled a bit. But with coffee, the passion has allowed you to do that. To make the transition from the passion and the interest and the curiosity and wanting to learn everything about it to actually, how can I also innovate and learn from a business perspective? Like, you've become a business model geek, I guess, or enthusiast as much as a coffee enthusiast.
So when I started, I was saying this to someone the other day, I totally agree. Like, I'm so really fascinated and passionate about business models now. And, I'd had my experience with that concept before was that it was dull and uninteresting. But it's super creative. Like, it's really fascinating. You know, it's just quite high risk. Yeah.
What sources do you... You were talking about getting a diversity of perspectives. What sources do you kind of visit or draw from on a regular basis to kind of keep yourself updated on what's going on in the different parts of the industry so you just kind of have your finger to the pulse and you know... You kind of have a feel for the industry, that sort of business owner's feel that I think is really essential for anyone who's in any industry.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is being engaged in conversation. Like, you know, I really think... There's no way that I would be exploring the things I'm exploring or have had the business opportunities without sort of the sort of global network that I've been able to become a part of. To be honest, though, that's easier than ever. It's really easy for an enthusiast in coffee to connect with people all around the world. The community's strong and it just prides itself on bringing people in if they're interested. But I remember when I got into it and it took me 3 years to get to a certain point of understanding. And then now I see someone come into it and they can get to the same point of understanding in 6 months. I think I kind of segment it. So I've got like research. So that's science. Science that will be published as a paper will often be a really narrow question, right? And it will be like X and Y were set and we found out that Z changed. And it won't tell you, it won't consider all the other variables. It'll often be done on one coffee, right? Like a Brazilian coffee. Or because when you have to set X and Y, inherently it's not representative of the whole marketplace.
Of course, yeah.
Then you've got research that gets released by the really big guys like the Nestle's and the Jab Holdings, Jacob Dabagberts, etc. Again, it's hard to get hold of that research, but it filters out. Then you've got like SCA trying to create an academic approach to coffee, trying to have a curriculum. You've got individuals as well around like a lot of anecdotal research in coffee, which on its own you should be a little bit wary of. But when it starts to add up, it becomes statistically significant. You know, sometimes subjectivity gets used to discount things, but sometimes the statistics are actually undeniable. Then I'm interested in all the business stories. So that's all my friends that I know who run businesses and listening to their experiences and talking to them. Then you've got like Coffee Business World. You've got a lot of the magazines like Sprudge, Coffee Daily Coffee News. They are all got a keen eye on the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got the big events like the Allegro events, the trade shows, obviously. Those trade shows, there's a lot of conversation around business in coffee. And that's where the conversation's moved, which is kind of what you were saying, right? These trade shows are as much about people's business concepts and what kind of products they're selling these days as it is about, oh, have you thought about grinding coffee this way?
Yeah.
And then, of course, you've got like, you know, coffee's become more retail than ever before. Specialty coffee was very B2B, very wholesale. So now we're all interested in presenting our products as retail products. And just to come back quickly, I totally realised I didn't say what I wanted to say about Nespresso earlier. I believe Nespresso is the best premium coffee brand of all time ever. And when you were asking me about what can we learn from bigger businesses, it's just, I'm even sort of ashamed it took me so long to notice. So we're all going, okay, how do we get people to understand quality? So ultimately, if you're interested in quality, you are willing to pay more. At a really basic level.
In any market.
In any market. So then we're all like, oh, we struggle to charge more for our coffee. People don't want to try different coffees, all this kind of stuff, right? You look at Nespresso, you're like, okay, forget that you know anything about specialty coffee and just put yourselves in the shoes of an average consumer. Their stores are called boutiques to start with. Right, and that you go into them and they're designed like French chocolatier stores. Like, they're super luxury. They pay more per gram of coffee than almost any other way of buying coffee. The person who's drawn to it wants to explore flavor. Now, even though Nespresso may have given it like blue, pink, well, they've got names actually, like Arpeggio. But the point is, they've tried to come up with ways for people to come and engage and choose, but ultimately their customers are exploring flavor, right? So you've got this fascinating situation that's happened, which is they built their audience. Like, that's hard. It costs a lot of money. Then you've got specialty coffee going mainstream and our whole independent scene getting so big that those ideas are now influencing these customers that are Nespresso's customers. So Nespresso's customers are now going, huh. I mean, I thought I was buying the best coffee, but actually, should it be a lighter roast or should it be a honey process? So they've done this amazing work for us.
So they've warmed up a big part of the mass market.
Well, what they've done is they've sort of rounded up the customers who are willing to engage in a premium quality experience, which is what we want, really, even though we don't realise it. What I said before, that sort of conflict between wanting to be sort of local and independent and fresh, that's not necessarily the same as high quality premium. So I think they'll become their own thing. So you'll have the premium sector and then you will have businesses who are saying, yeah, but we're come to us because it's local and it's fresh and it's independent. But in the past, that was all trying to be one thing, one space. Yeah, so in terms of like sources, I think you just have to be, you have to be humble. You have to believe that you haven't figured everything out. You know, you need to cast a wide net, but also you can't spend all your time researching. You know, like I'm a little bit of a, not a fan of the sort of self-help business guru books, right? Because I'm like, I swear the people who are actually building their businesses are not reading 20 of these books in 1 week.
Almost definitely not.
Now, it doesn't mean there's not some cool stuff in there.
Sure.
But ultimately, you just have to get on with it.
Yeah.
And you will learn so much from just doing it. Of course, plan, you know, to a degree. But ultimately, I think you need to not make really silly choices at the beginning. But you could say, let's say we've got someone who overplans. They're like super planned, but then they're not very adaptable. And they're like, oh, it's not going to plan, right?
Yeah.
And they find it really hard to let go of their plan. So I think, again, you know, you want to be careful you don't just pivot every week, like change your business model every week. Last week we're doing paninis. This week we're doing hummus. I don't know. Like, you need to be clear, but you need to... So there's this balance going on. And ultimately you don't learn, you know, until you've done it. I'm still learning tons about business, and I expect you're doing business in coffee, and I fully expect I always will be learning.
From your answer, I can tell there's a lot of things you're changing your mind about. You always change your mind about stuff.
Yeah.
Because you're... you know, continuing to learn and reintegrate stuff and kind of get a keener and keener sense of what it is that the customer wants. But that's always changing, right? It's dynamic. I guess that's the point.
Dynamic's a good word. And I think the coffee industry is definitely less precious about its right and wrongs than it's ever been. You know, and I think that's the sign of maturity of the industry. When I got into it and it was burgeoning, it was like, this is the right way, this is the wrong way.
Yeah.
You fast forward 10 years and some of the things we thought were wrong, we're now saying are totally right. But also just being like a little less, I don't know what the right word is, but for me, that you build that experience up, and when anything new comes along and they go, this is the right way now, the approach now is maybe, let's see. But ultimately, if there's more and more people interested in that whole discussion, that's really what the success of specialty coffee is, that people, whether we all agree on what the best coffee is or the best way to run a coffee shop, or for me, it's just a really dynamic industry that's, I think it's at an inflection point where it's going to get even broader, and more people are going to be involved in the conversation.
I think that's an awesome, encouraging note to end on. Maxwell, yep. Thanks so much for coming on the show. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Where can listeners find out more about you and what you do online?
You can Google my name. I have an unusual name, so my face comes up. you can follow us on social media. You can follow the Kelowna social media if you want to see the roastery. If you want to see me weightlifting, you can follow my personal social media. But if anyone listening has any questions, you know, I love to hear them. Reach out, speak to me. Yeah.
Awesome. We'll link to all of that in the show notes. Maxwell, thanks again.
Thanks a lot.
If you're interested in more insights and advice, you can access all of the bonus content from today's episode, including the episode transcript, on our blog at izettle.com, or direct from the link bit.ly/izettlepodcast. Just choose the episode you want, go to the page, and sign up on the form to access your bonus content. And finally, if you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating and review. Thanks for tuning in to Been There, Done That, and catch you next time.